Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 13th of April, these are our main stories. Details are emerging about the man said to be behind the huge US intelligence leaks. Norway is expelling 15 Russian diplomats it accuses of spying, and Ghana has become the first country to approve a malaria vaccine that's thought to be highly effective. Also in this podcast...
The whole idea of the clothes said, isn't life marvellous? It's marvellous to be a woman. It's marvellous to be alive and to be a woman now, right now.
Mary Quant, the British designer who transformed dress styles in the 1960s, has died, aged 93. Dozens of apparently classified documents from the US military are circulating online, and it's caused alarm. The documents contain detailed information about the war in Ukraine, including the extent to which the US has infiltrated the Russian military services. It's a diplomatic nightmare. So who is behind it? Well, the Washington Post has interviewed someone who claims to know the man responsible. Paul Adams is our diplomatic correspondent and told us about the leaked documents.
They cover an enormous range of subjects. Obviously, a lot of them dwell on the war in Ukraine, on the state of the relative state of the two militaries, the Russians and the Ukrainian, on plans and preparations for a Ukrainian counteroffensive possibly to be launched in the coming weeks. But there are also lots of others that talk about the spread of Chinese technology, about the reach of the Russian private military company Wagner into various African countries and Haiti. I mean, there's just an absolute wealth of material.
So the big question, what do we know about the person who leaked the documents?
Well, we're beginning to get some pretty interesting insights into that, thanks to the American Washington Post newspaper, which has spent quite a lot of time talking to someone who claims to know the identity of the leaker, who is described simply as OG, and an absolutely fascinating insight begins to emerge of a group of young men who came together in the early months of the pandemic lockdown, when everyone will remember we were all feeling a bit lonely. And they came together and started discussing a number of subjects. And OG, who claimed to be living on an American military base, started sharing classified information, which at that point he was simply writing out by hand. But as time went on, and in particular early this year, he started to share photographs of classified material, the material that we are all now poring over. According to his friends, he's not a whistleblower. He is a young, charismatic gun enthusiast. He has disdain for the US government, but he is not, in the view of the person interviewed by the Washington Post, actively acting against the interests of the US government. He merely is rather hostile to it. But fascinatingly, this group of young men is supposed to have included a number of foreign nationals, including Russians and Ukrainians. So the American authorities are now staring at the possibility that for the last 3 years, classified information has been shared not just with young Americans, but with a number of people around the world. And what we have been looking at since last week may only be the tip of a rather considerable iceberg. This is the implications of this are utterly horrendous.
If OG isn't actually hostile to the United States, do we know what his motivation actually was?
Well, it seems to have been to kind of share and educate those who gathered around him, some of whom sort of regarded him as something of a kind of, not a father figure exactly, but they obviously looked to him as someone who had authority. He was critical of the government, but this follower of his insists that he was absolutely not a whistleblower. He was merely educating those around him. And so, you know, we do get this picture of a God-fearing patriot, if you can use that word, you know, interested in, you know, guns and the military, with this, you know, coterie of people around him, who seemed to hang on his every word. And when he was conscious that some of them weren't, he kind of upped the ante and increased the quality and quantity of the amount of material he was sharing with them, suggesting perhaps that he wanted to impress them.
Paul Adams. Mary Quant, one of Britain's most important and revolutionary designers, whose clothes came to symbolise the 1960s, has died. She was 93. Although she said she was unaware that what she was creating was pioneering, Mary Quant helped shape a new youthful identity for post-war Britain and beyond. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones looks back at her life.
Hot pants, coloured tights and miniskirts.
A young woman has changed the dress ideas, the outlook on clothes of the new generation throughout the Western world, Mary Quant.
Mary Quant's trailblazing designs created a uniform for a new age. But it wasn't just a new way of dressing. It suggested a new way of thinking.
The whole idea of the clothes said, isn't life marvellous? It's marvellous to be a woman. It's marvellous to be alive and to be a woman now, right now. They were very, very optimistic times and a very optimistic look.
Born to Welsh parents, Mary Quant grew up with austerity and clothes rationing. Her first job was trimming hats, and when she opened her first boutique in London, she sold other people's clothes. But despite her lack of formal training, Mary Quant soon began to make her own. Before her, teens wore tweedy skirts and twin sets. Her designs celebrated fun and freedom.
I hated fashion the way it was. I wanted clothes to be far more casual, you know, easygoing and yet sort of sexy and things. And I didn't like the artificiality that went on at the time. But I didn't realise that so many other people felt the same.
She moved into perfume and cosmetics. Her products were mass-manufactured, marketed with the distinctive Daisy logo and exported around the world. The Mary Quant name became one of the first international lifestyle brands. Fashion is not frivolous, she once said. It is part of being alive today.
Rebecca Jones on the life of Mary Quant, who's died aged 93. Malaria kills more than 600,000 people each year, most of them young children in Africa. But there are hopes we could be reaching a turning point. Ghana has become the first country to approve a new vaccine that's been described as a world changer by the scientists at Oxford University who developed it. The vaccine, called R21, appears to be much more effective than previous efforts in the same field. Adrian Hill is a professor of vaccinology at Oxford.
This is a vaccine that's been in development for some years now. It's designed particularly to be effective in young African children, where most malaria deaths occur in that age group. And it's again a partnership between the University of Oxford and the Serum Institute of India.
Naomi Grimley is our global health correspondent. So just how effective is this new vaccine?
We have phase two data from trials that took place in Burkina Faso, and they showed effectiveness of 80% when given in three doses and then a booster dose a year later. And that's significantly more effective than a previous malaria vaccine developed by GlaxoSmithKline, which the WHO is already rolling out across Africa. That has efficacy of less than 50%, though it's always been used in conjunction with other things like insecticides and bed nets. So that's why people have got excited about this vaccine. I should just add that the final phase of data is due later this year, but they have given regulators in countries like Ghana a sneak preview, and that's why Ghana's decided to fast track it.
And does approval mean that anyone there who needs it can get it?
Well, firstly, it's approved for children there, so we're talking about ages of 5 months through to 3 years. And secondly, you've really hit on the next problem, because although this is a low-cost vaccine, so we're only talking about $3 per dose, much less than the previous vaccine I was talking about a moment ago, nevertheless, still that needs to be funded, that needs to have infrastructure to roll it out, and so far we don't have any of those details from the Ghanaian government, despite trying to contact them yesterday about this.
Just how significant is the development of an affordable vaccine against malaria for the world?
Well, it is very important because this has been the sort of holy grail of medicine, really, to try and find a malaria vaccine for decades. The reason is that the malaria parasite has a complicated life cycle, so it's always been very hard for scientists to know how to target it. But it does look like they've now perfected it, and the team at Oxford University, the Jenner Institute, so that's the same outfit that developed the COVID vaccine, the Oxford COVID vaccine, they are certainly very proud of their achievement, and they're pretty confident that that final phase of data will bear out this high efficacy. The other thing to add is that they do seem to have plans to produce large quantities of it, so in conjunction with the Serum Institute of India, they're talking about between 100 to 200 million doses per year. So that's also a significant legacy of the COVID pandemic, that they have the infrastructure now to produce large quantities.
That was Naomi Grimley. Paraguay's Gran Chaco is part of South America's second largest ecosystem. Now a new highway being driven from east to west is going to change the landscape and the communities who call it home forever. The so-called Bioceanic Corridor will transport the produce of cattle ranchers and soybean farmers in Brazil and Paraguay across to ports in Chile on the Pacific West Coast. But will the environmental and social costs be worth it? Bob Howard reports from Paraguay.
The Paraguayan stretch of the transcontinental bioceanic corridor is a massive construction project. The main objective is to unite the Atlantic Ocean with the Pacific Ocean, from the port of Santos in Brazil to the ports of Antofagasta and Iquique in Chile. The Paraguayans hope it will really help put this small, landlocked country, surrounded by huge neighbours like Brazil and Argentina, on the map. Alfredo Sanchez is one of the head engineers on the government team building the new road.
The truth is that this new road is completely changing the Paraguayan Chaco. Now people will have much easier access via the new road to hospitals, schools, so things will change for the better for all communities.
It will also bring much easier access to markets. Environmentalists estimate that cattle and other farms have grown in a century from using around 60,000 hectares of land to now reach around 4.5 million. And they say this enormous growth is threatening indigenous communities, as well as the thousands of plant species and hundreds of birds and animals found across the Chaco. Large tracts were bought by Mennonites, Anabaptist Christians who settled in the Gran Chaco 100 years ago in order to live in relative isolation. Patrick Friesen is a representative of one of the most important Mennonite communities in Paraguay. He admits that the pace of change is accelerating even more with the bioceanic corridor, to the extent that it could threaten the society the Mennonites have created.
International conglomerates with almost unlimited buying power would establish themselves in the Chaco. We believe there will be a lot of challenges because the concept of Mennonite colonies is based on isolation, is based on complete autonomy.
The Gran Chaco forest is Latin America's second largest ecosystem, a mix of hot and arid scrublands and forests and wetlands. Sabine Vinque, with her husband Thomas, runs a remote nature reserve where they film some of a TV program called Paraguay Salvaje, or Wild Paraguay, to share with people their passion for the beauty of the Chaco.
20 years ago, you have to go out half an hour and you have been in a native forest. Now we have the national parks, but all the rest is more or less going.
Today, the law says farmers are supposed to only deforest half of any land which they acquire. Much now rests on how safe the El Chaco National Parks are from development. Mario Abdo, Paraguay's president, insists adequate protections are in place.
It's a concern. Paraguay has very strong conservation laws regarding the preservation of our forests. If the laws are respected, I believe that Paraguay will continue to develop in a sustainable and environmentally sustainable manner.
Those assurances may not be enough to satisfy some members of the indigenous communities, like Taquide Pikanarai. He says promises have been broken before, and the Gran Chaco is effectively seen by politicians and businesses as just a large resource to generate profits.
Without territory for us, there is no life. For me, that is the biggest motivation, because I am here because my land exists. If it doesn't exist, I wouldn't exist either.
That report by Bob Howard in Paraguay. Now, let me just interrupt proceedings to let you know that in about 3 weeks, we'll be bringing you a special edition of the Global News podcast to mark the coronation of King Charles III in London. And we want to hear from you. Have you met King Charles, the artist formerly known as Prince Charles, perhaps when he was on a state visit to where you live? If so, please send us a voice message with your story of the occasion to our usual email address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Now, still to come.
It almost looks a little bit like a pigeon in both size and appearance, and it has a little bit more brownish of a colour.
Why that little brown bird is offering inspiration to scientists. We'll be right back after this.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
It's a cyber criminal group.
It was the Lazarus Group again.
These are smart guys.
The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
We're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. By diplomatic standards, this was quite a swoop. 15 Russians working at the country's embassy in Norway have been expelled for being spies. Norway's foreign minister, Anniken Huitfeldt, said in a statement, "Russia currently poses the greatest intelligence threat to Norway. We will not allow Russian intelligence officers to operate under diplomatic cover." So what is going on? Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, explained.
Well, we haven't had any great details. The usual diplomatic euphemisms have been used, that these people were conducting themselves in a way not compatible with their status. But it must be serious for them to get rid of 15, which, as you say, is a very large number. I mean, it's no secret that in any embassy, some of the diplomats are likely to be spies. I mean, if you want to get spies into a country, there's a limited number of ways you can do it. And appointing them to be, I don't know, economic attaché is probably a very simple one. Whether a country takes action against them, though, it depends on several things. First of all, it's how serious is their spying? Are they just, you know, collecting vague information about mood in the military? If they're snooping around nuclear bases or trying to bribe members of the armed forces to spill their secrets, or, you know, having affairs secretly with senior politicians in a way to blackmail them, any of these could get you expelled. But it's also going to depend on the global situation. Previously, you know, Norway probably wouldn't mind it having a few Russian spooks doing what spooks do, and they can play cat and mouse with them, chasing them around the fields, presumably. But the invasion of Ukraine has changed everything. It's changed everything everywhere, but particularly in Norway, simply because it does have a border with Russia right up in the Arctic Circle. There's also the sheer number. If 15 diplomats were spying, I think Norway might have thought, well, that's just taking the mickey. Either way, they've clearly decided to act. Russia said it will respond to the expulsions. No details yet. These things are usually tit for tat. So my guess is at this moment, there must be a dozen or so Norwegians in Moscow getting ready to, you know, pack their toothbrush, buy a bit of last-minute vodka at a cheap price before saying goodbye.
This isn't the first spy scandal to hit Norway recently, is it?
No, and that presumably is why we heard the strong language you mentioned from the Norwegian foreign minister. Last October, police arrested a man who was supposed to be called José Assis Jamaria, supposedly a researcher from Brazil. He was at Tromsø University in Norway's far north, researching security policy. Now, colleagues had apparently noticed that this supposed Brazilian didn't seem to like speaking Portuguese much, which is the national language of Brazil. That aroused a few suspicions. He was arrested and turned out to be a man called Mikhail Mikushin, a member of Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU. And they also, at the same time, arrested six people who were flying drones near militarily sensitive areas. They all turned out to be Russians. At the time, Russia said that Norway was suffering from hysteria. I would suggest today's events make it seem like the authorities beg to differ.
And just briefly, Paul, how do Norwegians generally feel about this?
It's really sensitive. When I was there, it struck me that, you know, this isn't an abstract matter. Because of that border up near the Arctic Circle, also all Norwegians do military service, the men anyway, and some women. They've practiced in the north to repel a Russian invasion. It's a very real thing, and clearly the country's taking it very seriously.
That was Paul Moss. Human rights groups say Iran carried out a hugely increased number of executions last year as anti-government protests took place across the country. At least 582 people are reported to have been hanged. That's a 75% rise on the previous year. Mike Thompson reports.
The Norway-based group Iran Human Rights and Paris-based Together Against the Death Penalty, who compiled the figures, say the big increase in executions was aimed at intimidating the population as nationwide protests raged. They claim international attention on the fate of demonstrators led the regime to hang mostly drug offenders and others instead, the intention being to spread fear among protesters, many of whom faced charges that carried the death penalty. Ethnicity was also a factor. 30% of the nearly 600 people hanged were from the country's Baluch minority.
Mike Thompson. In Sudan, there are concerns over a potential clash between the army and the country's biggest paramilitary group, known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The two forces worked together to stage a coup back in 2019, but their relations have worsened. Now, the army says the RSF is mobilising its forces in several cities, including the capital Khartoum. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross told us more about the Rapid Support Forces.
This is a very powerful paramilitary force, many tens of thousands strong, and it's deployed in most states across the country. And in the past, it's worked together with the National Army itself, and there haven't been too many tensions. But people may remember the word Janjaweed, going back to the conflict in Darfur a couple of decades ago. And basically, the Janjaweed was a state-sponsored militia that was formed in order to counter a rebel insurgency. And then the Janjaweed kind of morphed into this Rapid Support Forces, and it's headed by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, Mr. Hameti, who is the number two in the country, the second to the General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who's the military leader. And it's clear that the RSF and the military have been quite heavily involved in businesses as well as security. So there's a lot at stake here as these two forces, you know, are in some kind of danger of clashes at the moment.
And what are the two sides saying about the current situation? And what impact can all this have on plans for a political transition and for elections?
The surprise announcement overnight from the army was this statement accusing the RSF, these forces, of mobilising across the country and setting up in various cities, including Khartoum, and really saying that this was a violation of the law. And there are some reports from security sources that the army's given the RSF 24 hours to withdraw its forces. But General Hameti, as he's known, he's saying that this was all done in conjunction with the army. These RSF forces have deployed as normal and there's no problem. But this all seems to be part of a power struggle between these two people who stand to lose a lot when the country returns to civilian rule. But that transition to civilian rule at the moment's being delayed because of the tensions within the security forces.
That was Will Ross. Now, most scientific discoveries come from studying nature and adapting the knowledge for human use. Well, here's yet another example. The sand grouse, a bird found mainly in the deserts of southern Africa, has been found to have a unique ability. It carries drinking water in its feathers. And a team of scientists have found that there might be ways of adapting the system for human use. Bola Masuro has been finding out more about the sand grouse from one of the scientists involved in the research, Professor Jochen Muller of Johns Hopkins University.
It almost looks a little bit like a pigeon in both size and appearance. And it has a little bit more brownish of a color. And there are 16 species of sand grouse. And we were particularly interested in the one called Namaka sand grouse, which lives in the southern central part of Africa.
And why you were particularly interested is the way the male sand grouse carries water.
So most feathers in birds are actually water repellent. So they don't want to soak in any water because it would make them heavy and prevent them from flying. So these sand grouse have this really unique ability, I should say, to carry water in their belly feathers. And the way that this works is like these feathers in general have typically different levels of almost hierarchy. So we have the shaft, which is kind of the stem. And then branching off the shaft, we have something called barbs. And then another branching from these barbs is called barbules. And these barbules are actually curled. These are like coils, and these coils form some sort of little tube. You can think of a drinking straw. But these tubes now can soak up the water almost by themselves.
How does the water get into the feathers? Is it that the bird immerses itself in the water and therefore does it in that way?
Yes, exactly. So the birds fly to typically the water holes in these dry regions, and then they stand just in the shallow water and just dip their belly feathers in, and then they shake them back and forth and fluff them up a little bit while they're in the water. And that allows the water to really be exposed to these feathers or vice versa. And that's the initial contact with the water.
You and your team feel that you can use the same kind of architecture that is natural to this bird for human use?
There's a lot of super interesting and exciting applications we can think of. For example, during COVID, we used these cotton swabs for, these nasal swabs to get the fluid out of our nose and over to the labs. And these cotton swabs are actually not super efficient in taking in the fluids and then especially in releasing these fluids. So we could think of really creating these swabs that are inspired by the sand grouse feathers to more efficiently take in the fluids and then also release them. Other examples include brushes, paint brushes, blankets that could, for example, soak up oil spills in the oceans, but not water. So basically blankets that are specialized in both the materials and the structures to soak in the water, but then also release it and be reused. And my collaborator, Lorna Gibson, is very interested, for example, in nets that could be used in arid regions to get the water out of the air.
Professor Jochen Müller on the water-carrying abilities of the sand grouse. And yes, I will retweet his rather nice video of that clever little brown bird. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith. The producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.